morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 2 minutes after 9 a.m., January 18th, 2012. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and Senator McGuire. I'd like to welcome everybody back for the first meeting of the Senate Finance Committee for the second half of the session, the 27th Legislature. Last year we started a little later because at the beginning of the first session we have no bills in Senate Finance. We have to wait for the committee process to go forward and move that legislation up. So we're changing the order a little bit from last year in that we're starting off with some legislation before we go into our overviews and start some of our major subject matters. It's just kind of a general overview of the direction of the committee. And we have two bills on the agenda this morning. House Bill 104, Alaska Performance Scholarship, Senate Bill 86, Protection of Vulnerable Adults, and then Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 16 have been postponed. I'd like to go ahead and make a special welcome, of course, to our support staff here in the room that keeps things running. I'd like to go ahead and introduce our Finance Committee support staff. They're a tremendous resource to the committee, and without them, we wouldn't be able to start on time, end on time, and clearly have adequate documentation of what we do here. I'd like to go ahead and start with Donnie Gott, if you could. Where is she hiding at? You stick your hand up so people can kind of put the name with the face. Allison Holtkamp. Where's Allison at? There she is, hiding behind the screen. Marta Lustufka?
Yeah.
Did I get it close? Close enough? I was teasing her before the meeting. I was going to rename her Marta Lutefisk. I could pronounce that one. Matt Bruning. He's going to help us here, and I think he's going to be on the computer terminal on his second meeting, which will be Friday. Bree Wiley. And Louise Taylor Thomas. So those are our support staff. We have the same, pretty much Senate Finance Committee staff. I have one new person here dealing with the capital budget. We'll deal with that when the time comes. But with that, I'd like to go ahead and start off this winter with House Bill 104 by the governor regarding the Alaska Performance Scholarship. This is the first hearing on this bill here in Senate Finance, and the intent today is to have the sponsor introduced the bill, take public testimony, and then we're going to set the bill aside for further review. And just as a note, we do have cleanup language that will come back in later on at probably the next hearing, and there's been several inquiries into potential amendments and changes and stuff. But for today, we're just going to hear the bill, go through the public hearing process, and then we'll go ahead and in a future date take a look at working with the department on requests for changes and go through the process there. But with that, I'd like to go ahead and invite Diane Behrens, the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission of Postsecondary Education, if she can come forward. And she can go ahead and present the bill. And just as a reminder for the folks at home and in the audience that just the general layout of the committee structure is not going to change. We're going from previous, we're going to go ahead and, like in this case, we'll start with the guest that will introduce the bill. We'll come to the committee for initial committee members' questions, which are normally looking for, you know, large gaps in maybe understanding the subject matter or questions of the subject matter in front of us. Then we're going to have a presentation of the fiscal notes. And in this case, there's a new one this morning, so I'm not even real familiar with that. Then we'll go on to public testimony online, which is outside of Juneau here. And then we'll bring it into the room testimony. And then we'll come back to the committee if they have any questions or issues that they want to work on briefly at the committee. And then we'll set this bill aside. But as a note for those watching again at home, most of the work, the time element of the work on these subjects are done normally with staff and also the senators outside of the committee in their offices. So we won't spend a laborious amount of time at the committee doing fundamental bill work. We'll do that in our offices and then bring back a product that's closer to whatever finished product that it appears that we're going to have for final tune-up here at the committee with the discussion and debate and potential voting up and down on amendments or whatever issue we may have. So just as a reminder, and then also we have no cell phones. If everybody can remember to turn their cell phones off. A lot of times we get into a lot of detailed information in these subjects. This could be one of them, quite frankly, where a bill sponsor or a presenter or possibly a senator may have a question and it may be missed if there's distractions in the room or an answer, particularly when we get into financial discussions, because sometimes it'll be just a brief comment that somebody makes that's actually a big issue. And either it's not, it doesn't appear to be a big issue, or they don't want to talk about the big issue. But if the committee misses it, it's not advantageous to the process. So we also, at the committee here, don't, or we avoid distractions like reading newspapers, having people approach the table. We'll, if anybody has a question or concern, or if he thinks that there's an issue that he wants to, or she wants to have a pause, or if we get tired, somebody wants a break, just signal me and we'll take a 5-minute at ease or what have you to go ahead and deal with that. And then again, we'll have our committee aides will pass notes up to us through our staff to help the orderly process. And what we don't allow, and again, this is just fundamental rules, but what we don't allow is people from the audience to approach the table. And on rare occasions that does happen, but if that does happen, then we'll be stopping the meeting and dealing with the protocol issues. And it normally doesn't happen until we get into a real hot issue, normally later in the session. Those are just some of the rules. Also, iPads, we won't be having iPads here at the table. We may deal with that later on at some point, but I want to make sure that the committee members are paying full attention to the presenters, because to some presenters it's intimidating, this process. They're not familiar with it. A lot of them, it's their first time. And even like Diane Behrens, who's been here many times and knows all of us, it's just not good protocol to ignore the presenter if you like what she has to say or don't like what she has to say. We need to give them the full respect of the committee. With that, Ms. Behrens, if you could take it away, tell us what's in this bill and why we should here at the committee support this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. And I would like, firstly, to express my appreciation on behalf of the administration for you hearing this bill so early in the process. The governor's original request for, through HB 104 had two pieces, one more housekeeping, the other clearly substantive. It was to modify the name of the program to address potential trademark infringement regarding the merit scholarship phrasing, and to provide the substantive piece to provide for a stable, dependable source of funding for the statewide scholarships. Given the nature of the commitment we're asking students to make, he seeks to establish a recurring fund source so that the state is able to meet its commitment and investment in Alaska's young people. Through the legislative process, the bill before you today has been modified. The bill's scope has been broadened appreciably to include funding not only for the performance scholarship, but also for Alaska Advantage education grants, the state's only need-based financial aid for post-secondary education. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I would just briefly discuss the contents of the bill. Sections 1 through 4, 7, 9, 13, and 16 are essentially the housekeeping components, renaming the scholarship program. Section 5 clarifies a new process in the event of a funding shortfall. It makes clear that those students who are already funded in the pipeline would have priority for funding, and no new students would be accepted into the scholarship program. Section 6, although it does have some renaming components, adds requirements that are applicable to post-secondary institutions seeking to participate in the performance scholarship program. It indicates that these institutions must provide mandatory counseling services for the students and must ensure that the courses needed for them to complete their degree or certificate program on time are made available to the students. Sections 8, 10, and 14 are the sections that establish both accounts into which funds would be deposited to fund both scholarships and grants, as well as a fund into which appropriations would be made. It specifies that the income earned on the investments and donations to the fund are permitted. It also talks about a funding scheme. Of course, these changes were made prior to the actions that the legislature took in the latter stages of last year's session, so it sort of anticipates that there would be a series of funding appropriations to capitalize the fund, and then the monies would remain in there with the proceeds moving from the fund to the account for actual scholarships and grants on an annual basis. Sections 11, 12, and 19 create tax credits for corporate citizens to make contributions to the performance scholarship and education grant fund, and deal with a sunset provision to ensure that after this sunset provision, which is already in statute, to ensure that the contributions to the scholarship fund remain eligible for the credit in subsequent years. Section 15 contains transition language, and sections 17 through 20 are essentially effective date sections. I would note that the new requirements for institutions would have an effective date, ideally a year later, to allow institutions to put all of the elements in place to meet the requirements for both the counseling and the course scheduling requirements. And Mr. Chair, that essentially is the bill that's before you today. Clearly, with the actions that the legislature took in passing SB 76 last session, the funds have been set aside to capitalize this fund. So I believe conforming changes to the bill would be appropriate, and we stand ready to work with the committee to bring back a bill that is acceptable to all parties.
Ms. Burns, maybe you could, for the audience at home, I know most of us in the room have been around the block on this issue, quite a bit, but, for those watching, we should tell them what this bill is. What's it do?
Certainly. Well, this bill modifies a program that was actually put in statute in 2010, 2009, which created a program that incented young Alaskans to take a rigorous course of study in high school, to work hard, to get a good GPA, and to master the content of those subjects to the extent that they could score well on national exams. The first class of students that were eligible to receive the scholarship were the high school graduating class of 2011. In that original bill, the Commission, the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, and the University of Alaska were directed to report on the outcomes of the scholarship program. That report is due to the members here within 10 days of the start of this session, and we look forward to delivering that report. Just a couple of highlights from it. We had approximately 2,400 young Alaskans who graduated in 2011 who were eligible to participate in the scholarship. Over 900 of them have taken advantage of that. And we believe that while that was, we had anticipated a greater number of students actually taking advantage of the scholarship. What we learned through surveying them was that given the tentative nature of the funding status last year, many of them had already made plans to go outside the state. The scholarship is not portable. It must be used at an institution in the state, although it can be used for both vocational training as well as traditional associate or baccalaureate degrees. So we saw, of the eligible students, we saw almost as many of them attend an institution outside the state as those that actually attended in the state. So over time, we expect to report back on any trends in both the eligibility for the scholarship as well as the utilization.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you refresh our memories on how the fund would be split between the Alaska Advantage Education Grant Fund and the Alaska Performance Scholarship Fund?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, at this time there is no prescribed formula for a proportional split. There was discussion during the legislative process last year to do just that, but the version that comes to you today does not have a formula embedded in it.
And I know that there is a lot of interest in the Alaska Advantage Education Grant Fund, and I think that many of the legislators are interested to have an assurance that what portion would be going to that fund, and I'm wondering if the administration has a recommended split in that regard.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there was a discussion last year about a one-third, two-third split that seemed palatable to the administration. So I think that was the formula that was on the table.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman, with that one-third, two-third split, does the administration feel that the $400 million that's set aside for this program would be adequate?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it would be. We have actually updated. I understand one of the fiscal notes got to you late, and I apologize for that, Mr. Chair. The utilization rates for the scholarship have been adjusted based on our actual experience this year. We had, in the prior fiscal notes, had to estimate based on a proxy. We used another state's experience as a proxy. So actually the costs that are contained in the fiscal notes that have been updated are slightly less than the earlier fiscal notes. And I would defer to the folks at Revenue to discuss what income they believe the $400 million would generate rather than speculate about that myself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there initial questions from committee members? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the concept of the amount of people that applied for it, what is the process or what is in place now to promote or market or advertise the scholarship plan?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we at the commission are working very closely with both the Department of Education Early Development and the Governor's Office to share the marketing of this program. There is a staff person at the Department of Education that is charged with communicating with the schools. So they actually transmit information about the program to the schools, for the counselors, the principals, the superintendents. The commission, on the other hand, does direct marketing. We do mailings twice a year to the targeted population. We're able to use both information from the Department of Education and information from the Permanent Fund Dividend Division to identify students and their addresses, and we actually send information about the program to them directly. Beyond that, we do not have a specific marketing budget. We didn't ask for any operating funds with this program. But beyond that, our outreach staff, which are based in Anchorage, have developed a series of PSAs, public service announcements for both radio and TV, and we target that at key times of the year when students are thinking about college, planning for college, and get those on the air in the around the state.
Thank you.
Any other initial questions? Senator Elder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, thanks for being here. You know, throughout the discussion of this legislation, there's been concern about the realistic access of rural students, students in small communities, to the rigorous courses necessary to qualify for the merit scholarships. And the answer from the administration is, well, we're trying, we're working on it, we're hoping someday that there will be realistic, reasonable access of rural students in smaller communities to these rigorous course offerings, and, you know, they can take classes over the computer and this and that. Do you, are there any changes that we can make in this legislation to address that, not to water down the program, but to actually address the realistic access of small community and rural students to rigorous course offerings so that they could compete with the other students for these merit scholarships?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I believe Commissioner Hanley's in the room and may want to personally address that issue. I don't believe there's a change to the statutory language around the program that is really will make that change. I believe you'll find in reviewing the report that we'll be delivering to the members that we did have eligible individuals from very small, remote communities in the state, clearly showing that it is possible to do. I think it's been acknowledged that it is certainly more of a challenge in certain schools than in those in our urban centers, but the possibility is there. But you are correct. It has to be something that is readily available to the students rather than something that they have to sort of create out of whole cloth themselves. And I'm not sure if the commissioner wants to.
Well, we'll do that later. We got to go through the fiscal notes and whole process.
Thank you.
You want to come back for a follow-up there, Senator Hoffman?
Yes, on that same topic, there were, I think, some advertisements last year that said that there were students available that would have been eligible for the grants to try to get support for the legislation. And I'm wondering if that analysis has been done by school district and how many would qualify in rural areas versus urban areas, and I wonder if that is that analysis can be done and be provided to the to this committee.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, if I understood the question, I'm not sure I actually heard all of it, but you're looking for a comparison of qualifying students in rural areas versus urban?
For graduates from last year.
Yeah, that is included in the report.
Thank you.
I would just alert you to the fact that there are certain federal education privacy rules that would prevent us from reporting on very small numbers of students because it could result in them being identified as individuals. So in the report, we were required to roll up numbers so that the N, if you will, the number involved, was above a certain level. So for very small schools, if you had two or three seniors, we had to roll that up to a district or regional level.
Are there initial questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the increases by the university as far as tuition over the last 10 years or so, just about 50% increase in tuition, has there been any discussion in the administration as to how to address that issue in the future going forward as some kind of inflation proofing, or at least the idea of addressing that with some regularity of what takes place as far as the increases to the scholarships, or is that anything you've even taken a look at?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we have not actually looked at this. The scholarship levels were pegged to the 2010-11 tuition. So you will see an erosion in the buying power, if you will, of the scholarship awards. But the dollar amounts are set in statute and could be revisited on a regular basis.
Thank you.
Senator Egan and Senator Schur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, in the last year, there was great discussion on merit and needs-based. I'm just curious on how much needs-based requests.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, we funded just over 2,000 students with education grants this year with the increased funding level. We believe to fully fund the program based on our current application volume. If I have it here. All in, it would be just under $7 million to fund all student applicants. And that's based on a pool of about 4,400. So we had about 4,400 applying this year. We were able to fund 2,000 of those.
So this
would
fund just less than
half,
right?
Correct.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Behrens, thank you very much for presenting this bill. Again, education is one of those things that I feel, you know, determines what our future is going to be like, especially from those students that are so vulnerable. But looking at the issue of the rural school districts, as was pointed out by other members of the committee, I'd have a hard time supporting this type of legislation because it seems to put the rural districts at a disadvantage. And this is just a comment, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure we can do it later, and I'll have specific questions for other, after we're done going through the bill. But I certainly have some difficulty with supporting this type of legislation until we get a more equal footing for both rural students as well as urban students. Okay. Having been raised under the old BIA system and going off to higher education, there's got some pretty strong feelings on it, Mr. Chairman.
Any other initial questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll walk through some of the fiscal notes. I'm going to make a few comments on those, and we'll jump into the public testimony. And I did mention earlier, and just looking in the room, pretty much everybody, almost everybody, there's a couple of young faces in the back, but we have sign-up sheets in the back. If you want to testify, make sure you get your name on the sign-up sheet so I can roll through that. I know some folks here are just here to watch, and some here because they have something to say to the committee. So, and I don't know the difference unless you sign up on the sign-up sheet. There are five updated fiscal notes in your packet, 2-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Revenue, Treasury, and Tax Division, 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Education and Early Development, 2 fiscal notes from the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education, 1 for the Alaska Performance Scholarship, reflecting a $2 million currently, that's in the governor's budget request, as well as out-year cost estimates. 1 for the program administration operation of an additional FY13 appropriation request in the amount of $3,996.2, with increasing amounts in the out-years. And like I said, one of them had just come in this morning, so it's pretty fresh information. But with that, I'd like to go to start the public testimony portion. We'll start with the online, and what I'd like to do is bring up Robin Wilson from the Department of Revenue. Please, Robin, if you can identify yourself and who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please. And we'll probably have some questions for you also.
Yes, this is Robin Wilson. I manage the corporate income tax program for the Department of Revenue, and I'm available for questions.
Any questions for Robin? On the tax credit, can you remind me what the net effect is to the state on the credit mechanism, which is Section 11?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the net effect to the state, this bill does not raise the total credit available, so it doesn't. This bill does not change the net fiscal impact. It just adds another category for which an education credit could be claimed.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Wilson, thank you very much for being available this morning. One of the questions that I do have as far as a tax credit program, has there been any indication there have been people that want to go ahead and participate from the private sector?
Through the Chairman, Mr. Olson, it's as far as the last legislation, we have not received yet the tax returns that would report that. It's too soon to tell on that.
Okay, I'm assuming that there's been some type of study to go and look at to see if there are going to be any significant participants that are out there. And if that's not the case, then it looks like the state is going to be footing the full bill by itself. Am I correct in my assumptions?
Through the chair, Senator Olson. The Department of Revenue doesn't have any sort of study like that. And as it's written, it would be state-funded.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Ms. Wilson? Seeing none, we'll let you off the hook, Robin, but I'm sure we'll be hearing from you later in the session, probably more than once.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Do we have a sign-up sheet in the audience? We'll take a brief at ease. I'm surprised that there's nobody on a sign-up sheet that wants to come talk on this subject. It's a pretty big subject. But that's the way it is this morning. So, Senator Hoffman, you had a question or a comment before we set this bill aside?
Yes, I have a question on the fiscal note prepared by Diane Behrens, if she could. The one dated January 17th. It shows that between fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 2018, the number of recipients is going to increase by 35%. And I'm wondering how the fund is going to be managed to address that that substantial anticipated increase. Is the fund going to be inflation proofed to address this increased cost from 6.9 million to 9.6 million?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we have two, we have an ACPE-1 and an ACPE-2 fiscal note in the file name. Are you referencing ACPE-1 or ACPE-2?
I'm addressing the one that is noted by OMB as number 2738.
Okay, nope. Thank you. That is actually the fiscal note for the grant portion.
I'm aware of that.
Right, okay.
So my question is, the payout is going to increase from 6.9 million to 9.6 million. We are putting in 400 million into the fund. And is that fund going to be inflation-proof so that there will be no additional dollars needed to put into the fund for the 35% increase between FY13 and FY18?
Senator Hoffman, my discussions with the folks at Revenue have indicated that they're going to look at the expected payout and make investment decisions based on that to try to ensure that the fund itself is able to cover it. I would defer, I believe Jerry Burnett is here from Department of Revenue and could speak to that more specifically.
Because that seems to be a pretty high rate of return to accomplish that.
Maybe we can have Mr. Burnett come forward. He's also familiar with the table here. You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, Jerry, and then maybe help us with the whole, maybe start by kind of defining the, for those watching at home, the $400 million set aside, and then how your department feels, what kind of revenue it can throw off, and if there's shortfalls projected or surpluses on that.
Oh, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Alaska Department of Revenue. The 400, when the bill was originally introduced, the $400 million was to be invested in a fund that would have a 5% annual real rate of return. That was how it's, and inflation proofing. So it would be invested to earn somewhere around 7.75% to 8% in the current marketplace. And that would produce $20 million the first year, and that would go up. We're looking at less than $20 million in those first years. So looking at the fiscal notes and the costs of the program at this time, the Department of Revenue would be looking at an asset allocation that would be designed to build the fund for the future year payouts. So that's your question. If you were earning 7 or 8% or 5%, and you would be building the fund. In fact, since you put $400 million in the fund this year, the Alaska Housing Capital Corporation has more than $400 million that you would have available at this point, because it's been earning interest throughout the year. It's invested currently in our with the general investment fund. And so yes, but we would customize an asset allocation for this fund based on the $400 million and the future expected payments.
Mr. Chairman, what interest rate did it earn in during the first 6 months?
I don't know exactly. I can get you that information. Over the past several years, it's earned the 3 to 4% range in the general investment account. So, but depending on how, on the future needs, this one would be a customized asset allocation. We have in the Department of Revenue Treasury about 40, more than 40 different asset allocations for different funds, depending on the liquidity needs and the future expectations in there. And this would be done that way. The fiscal note that you have in your packet indicates that based on the House bill's language, that we would be leaving this money in Jafonzi, because the House bill limited the amount of money in it.
Mr. Burnett, maybe you just explain to us what Jafonzi is.
The general fund and other non-segregated investments. It's a general investment fund, which is all fixed income and invested for liquidity and return. So
that's where our CBR is and SBR. Our
the SBR is a CBR, yeah. Is a very similar,
right,
set of.
So, Mr. Chairman, my question is, will the $400 million grow by 35% between FY13 to 18, or anticipated to grow by that rate in order to meet the payout that's expected?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman, I believe that $400 million right now invested could potentially earn enough to meet that payout 2018, the 35% already. So we can customize an asset allocation that has a greater safety and lower probability of loss and still get to this relative to what we would have expected with a higher payout.
Mr. Burnett, maybe
in the early years.
Maybe the department can get back with the committee on a forecast to 2020, whatever, you know, time range you're comfortable with. Take the beginning of the $400 million and shoot it forward, and then show us your expectations for the withdrawals and then the payout. And this is very similar to the power cost equalization. Is, you know, we have basically a little endowment. The issue there, they're paying out, I think, 7%, and we're worried about erosion of principal there.
Right.
So it could get wrapped up in a larger conversation later on in the year when we start looking at these different pools of funds that we have oversight of?
Yes.
The other question, I haven't really went through in detail the operating budget, but what you're telling me is that the $400 million that is currently invested is going to, the earnings are going to be put into that fund, and you're going to be requesting additional funds above and beyond that into operation for the first year? Or are you saying that the $400 million that we put into the fund, we're going to use those interests to pay for the first year's operation?
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman, I'm not making any assertions about how you're going to, how the program will be funded in the first year. My comment was that the $400 million, because it was segregated and put in a fund that keeps its own earnings, there is more than $400 million available in that fund at this time for whatever purpose. The appropriation to this is $400 million. So that's a choice.
Any other questions for Treasury?
Mr. Chairman, I have another program question for Ms. Behrens. And it's taken me a while to get back into thoughts about this legislation from last year, but can students who attend alternative high schools like military academies, most of whom get GEDs, qualify for the merit-based scholarship programs? Most kids at the military academies, I'm told, get GEDs rather than conventional diplomas. That's true of foster children in foster care in Alaska as well. Kids in military academy and foster kids often come from, they're in those situations because of tumultuous family lives. Parents' actions and other family situations. So I'm just wondering how the program treats kids in those situations, military academies, foster kids, kids who are on the margins.
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, the currently a student must get a regular high school diploma in order to qualify, and that relates to the rigorous curriculum that they would be required to get. So that alternate pathway is not currently accommodated in this program.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. I just want to make a comment. I guess a question for you, Mr. Chairman. Is this the last hearing on this bill?
No.
Okay.
No, this is, again, this is the first hearing on this legislation. In fact, the hearings all this week will be first hearings. We have cleanup language coming we're working with the department on, and there's been some expression of some amendments and alterations. So we want to get it on the table so we can work through this process.
Okay, and then so just a comment, just to a couple of the comments I think that have been made around the table. And when you come back, if you could, Diane, and then the commissioner as well. This is the Finance Committee, and I think the tendency when we get here is to just talk about finance and numbers, but it's the last stop for the bill, and so I think a lot of the old emotions come out about the bill that might have been addressed in other committees. So I think what would be nice to hear in wrap-up would be sort of all the things that led to this bill, what we're trying to accomplish in terms of a rising tide lifting all boats, what this bill will do. And my personal belief about it is that this bill isn't going to accomplish everything. It isn't the scholarship for every student in the state of Alaska, but it is a scholarship for some of the exceptional students. And it's an opportunity to make a deal with certain students to say that irrespective of the deal that your parents might make, we're going to give you a hand up and out. With respect to rural students, I think that there could be some opportunities to craft unique circumstances. And I, in particular, would like to hear what Louisiana did with respect to their rural townships and online courses. We have Galena, for example, that has been an amazing model. What could we do to take that particular program and look to our rural school teachers and maybe craft something for those school districts that would help them bring more students into compliance? For example, rather than trying to say, let's not apply this performance scholarship because too few rural students will apply, let's try to bring more in. Similarly, with our military students, rather than saying, well, if a GED won't qualify, then let's just throw it all out. I think what we're trying to do here is spectacular. The opportunity that we are giving Alaska students to go forward and to have a future, and to say to them, you know, in tight economic times, we're going to not strap you with the burden of a scholarship for the rest of your life, I mean, of a loan for the rest of your life, is amazing. So I want to work with you. I extend that olive branch to you. I hope that when you come back to this committee that you'll recognize that even though it's the Finance Committee, you can hear that there is a bit of tension, that there's $400,000 or $400 million. How much more will it really cost to run this program? As we go through the decline of TAPS, there'll only be so much money left. Will we have enough to run the programs in rural Alaska? Will we have enough to run the programs that our needy students have as well? And so how will this fit into Alaska's future? And I think it's going to be incumbent on you and the commissioner to really sell this program to us. So I invite you to do that.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, if I could just respond. One of the things that we have been making an effort to do around the bill that's actually before you today, which is not the bill creating the program, we did go through that process. We had many hearings on that bill, and the legislature put the program into statute. We've had less than a year of operating the program, and we were actually hopeful that we would have several years of having the program operate as passed before going in and making substantive changes to the bill, which is why this bill was intended to do two things: change the program's name and fund the program that was previously approved. So I certainly appreciate the passionate, deep feelings that people have around this issue, but we do have a program that has had no opportunity to really demonstrate itself. So, you know, I would encourage folks to think about the benefits of actually having two or three years of track record to look at before starting to tweak, to fix things that we think may be broken with it. But I agree with you, this program was not intended to be a cure-all, and it was intended to help young people make the right decisions at an early time in their life by communicating with them in middle school about the impact of their decisions and trying to help them make the right decisions that are best for them. I know it's difficult and it's challenging, particularly when it's a young person without mentors around them. But I think it's the best place to start, and if we could allow the program to mature a bit before changing it, I think there's real benefits to that.
Yeah. Senator Olson, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. This is the Finance Committee, and I want to ask another question of Mr. Burnett having to do with the $400 million. It appears by what you're telling us that there's fairly optimistic that you're going to meet the $7.75 to $8 million net interest that's going to be out there based on what it's done in the last 6 months or so. It appears that it's only half of there. I guess what are the mechanisms or what kind of backup measures do you have in place to make sure students aren't left in the lurch when you don't make your goal? And my real question has to do with whether you're set up to go ahead and start feeding off the corpus of the fund that's there that was put in place.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I really can't, in fact, answer that question because we will, as I said, we need to look at the models for future funding and set up an asset allocation to do that. This could be set up as a endowment, so you pay out X percent per year from the fund to the other fund, and then you could, you know, in a down year, depending on how it's invested, you could have that kind of a mechanism so students wouldn't ever, you'd build up larger fund balances in good years and feed off the utilize some of the corpus in a bad year as an endowment model set up, or it could be set up, you know, with fixed income investments that match the timing on this. It depends on, you know, again, what the cash flow needs are and the amount. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. We'll await your analysis back to us. And just as a brief note, I think when we look at that, we'll be looking at a multi-year period and not so much the 6 month and extrapolating it
Right.
And then we're going to have, for those listening at home, we're going to have the permanent fund reviewed here at the table in a few weeks, along with the retirement system. They'll have similar market impacts on their performance. So we'll try to wrap all that together. We're also going to have a presentation, just as a side note, on the finances, we're going to have a presentation, I think, taking a look at the growth in the GDP relative to debt levels to try to get a better feel for what we can expect out of performance of our pile of assets that we've set aside, our cash. So we'll try to bring it all together at the end later on in the session. Senator Thomas.
Just one last item. I didn't quite grasp the response by Ms. Behrens to Senator Egan's question, so if maybe we could get that in written format, the number of applications for both programs, Alaska Advantage and Alaska Performance, and the number of folks that applied and the amount of money that was dispersed, that would be helpful for me anyhow.
I would appreciate the opportunity to do that, just in case memory was not sound.
Great. Thank you.
This is the first meeting, so it'll take a while to freshen everybody up. But yeah, go ahead and get that back to my office, and we'll dispense it around to the committee members. Any final questions before we set this bill aside? Okay, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. And then we're going to take up the next item of labor. We'll have a brief edges. Come back on the record. We're going to go ahead and pick up Senate Bill 86 by the governor regarding protection of vulnerable adults and minors. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further review. To present the bill today is Kimberly Poppy Smart from the Department of Health and Social Services, Deputy Commissioner of Medicaid and Healthcare Policy, and Joanna Gibbons, Deputy Director, Division of Senior and Disability Benefits. With that, I'd like to go ahead and have them come forward, please. And if you ladies could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then I'll let you tag team how you want to do it back and forth in the presentation of the information.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Kimberly Poppy Smart, Deputy Commissioner for Medicaid and Healthcare Policy, the Department of Health and Social Services.
And good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Joanne Gibbons, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services.
I want to thank you again for the opportunity to present this first hearing with you on this bill today. Joanne is here representing Senior and Disability Services because, as you read the bill, you'll notice Adult Protective Services mentioned a number of times. That service is hosted in our Senior and Disability Services Division. Short title being Protection of Vulnerable Adults and Minors. I intend to give you a high-level overview today of this bill. We have a number of experts on the subject matter within the bill, including individuals prepared to provide section analysis for you. Joanne will provide some specifics as to the impacts to Adult Protective Services. This bill was developed in collaboration with a number of partners, including the Department of Administration, the Department of Law, and today we have it available in the audience to conduct a section-by-section analysis, Kelly Henriksen, Assistant Attorney General, the Human Services Section of the Department of Law. On the phone, we have Scott Sterling, Supervising Attorney for the Office of Elder Fraud and Assistance in the Department of Administration. Also in the audience, from the Office of Public Assistance, we have Mr. Allen. On the phone from the Office of Public Assistance, we have Office of Public Advocacy, excuse me. We have attorneys Beth Russo and Beth Trimmer available. And the public safety is also available to respond, Catherine Monfredo, who is the chief for Criminal Records and Identification Bureau. We also have Lieutenant Rodney Dial, the Office of the Director, Alaska State Troopers, and David Shade, who is the Director of the Division of Statewide Services. I want to mention two very important elements of this bill that help cover some gaps that currently exist in our protective services to vulnerable adults. The first is the process of appointing a temporary conservator to an individual who is in need and at risk for imminent harm to their financial status or their healthcare decision making. This bill would allow the court to impose emergency conservatorship, which could be extinguished when it's no longer needed or renewed, to allow assistance in protecting financial assets, managing financial affairs, and to prevent that imminent waste or fraudulent dissipation of assets. The second most important element of this bill creates a process for the imposition of financial protective orders, again, to protect those assets of individual victims and other concerned parties. There is the ability to apply for a 20-day ex parte protective order to stop or prevent financial exploitation. Those tools are not currently available to Adult Protective Services and others who assist with our vulnerable adults. Also of import in this bill is the addition of mandated reporters. Currently, administrators of skilled nursing facilities or residential care facilities or other health care facilities are mandated reporters of suspected abuse, including abuse of a financial nature. However, this bill expands that obligation to individuals working within those institutions. It also expands the obligation to educators and employees of educational institutions. Some of our vulnerable adults are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds with developmental disabilities who are still in our school systems. It also adds the concept of undue influence as a reportable harm. Sometimes that seems like a squishy term, a little bit nebulous, but in fact, it means that a person of trust is abusing or misusing their power and applying undue influence to a vulnerable adult to get control over their healthcare decision-making, over the control of their assets or their finances. With these additional mandated reporters and the expanded list of coverage being the undue influence, we believe we'll have earlier detection and intervention for individuals at risk, those Alaskans who are vulnerable to loss of their property or loss of their free will to make healthcare decisions. We believe we'll be able to obtain earlier protective orders. We'll be able to have more thorough and successful investigations and to protect the assets during the course of the investigation. The temporary conservator who's appointed can assist in protecting those assets. We will be able to further provide protection to those assets through the protective order. This bill will amend the APS statutes to provide that additional protection that our vulnerable adults so need. It will enhance criminal penalties in criminal cases where abuse is to the elderly victim. In our broad summary, we believe this bill will provide the state of Alaska with the additional tools necessary to combat this growing problem of financial abuse in our elderly and disabled populations. Mr. Chairman, I would like Mrs. Gibbons to provide additional information as to the impacts to Adult Protective Services.
Okay, if you could, Ms. Gibbons.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to give the committee some figures and some examples as to how the financial exploitation issues occur out there in the real world. We have seen in Adult Protective Services a slow increase over the last number of years in the number of calls and concerns that we get regarding the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. And majority of those calls have to do with seniors, individuals over the age of 60, but we also get calls regarding concerns of individuals who have developmental disabilities and traumatic brain injuries as well. And in FY10, we substantiated 100 cases of financial exploitation. That went up to 125 cases in FY11. And in year-to-date, this fiscal year, we've already substantiated 85 cases. So you can see, as time goes on, that we're seeing more and more of these cases where we have the capability, at least, of substantiating. And the number of calls overall to Adult Protective Services are increasing year after year. Majority of the calls we get regarding financial exploitation, especially in relationship to this bill and the whole concept of undue influence, are cases where we have family members who are taking advantage of other family members, unfortunately. I can give you example after example of cases where elderly, ill parents might be living with one of their adult children. It could be that adult child has power of attorney and therefore has quite a bit of control over what happens to their elderly parent. We've had a number of cases where the adult child would take the money in the bank account, would have access to the credit cards, would buy themselves furniture, trips around the world, basically use their parents' assets for their own personal gain, and leave the parent with very minimal, if any, care. The way the system currently works, in a case, for example, where someone would have a power of attorney, we currently have, and if the state were to come in and we wanted to protect this individual, and we would ask that the person be removed in terms of power of attorney, the court has up to 120 days to have a hearing. We can't intervene before that hearing happens. And so usually by the time we get to that point, the bank account is empty. Everything's already gone. And this bill will give us the opportunity, the ability, with the undue influence statute, to respond sooner, and also with the legal, the ability to have an emergency, an ex parte order, or to have a temporary conservatorship, will definitely put things in place for us to hopefully be able to intervene much more quickly, and hopefully stop the depletion of all of their assets from occurring. So, and then one other thing I wanted to mention before we go on is, a lot of times people ask, well, why does that happen? I mean, why do individuals, you know, give their money away, and don't they understand that they're going to be destitute? And there's a couple of things, dynamics that we see going on. First of all, a lot of times people are embarrassed or afraid to call and let us know that they feel they're being taken advantage of, because it's family. And they do feel embarrassed that they're being taken advantage of. The other dynamic that we most frequently see is there's really an element of fear. Many times the elderly folks who are victims of this are, they've lost most of their friends. They, friends have passed. There's not many family members. They tend to be somewhat isolated, and all they might have is this person living with them. And they are so afraid that if they don't give them what they need, what they want, then they will go away too. And then they will really be alone. And the sad part of that is, sometimes that is what happens, because once all of the assets are gone, that person leaves anyway. And so anyway, that's kind of putting a human face on the bill and the impact that this issue has. And we thank you for your consideration.
We have initial questions. Senator Hoffman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the 210 cases in the last year and a half, Do any of those cases involve identity theft of seniors or vulnerable adults?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I don't know have the specific number, but we have had cases of identity theft, and we can certainly get those numbers to you.
And how does the legislation address identity theft in particular compared to the other cases of relatives and such taking care of seniors?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I would defer that question to one of our attorneys who's here, but I don't believe it talks about identity theft in particular.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were talking about some examples of cases, I'm assuming, though, that a lot of times when people get powers of attorney, it's because their parent or close relative has become disabled or mentally disabled through dementia or maybe Alzheimer's or something like that, and they're trusting this family member to manage their finances. And maybe they don't have the capacity to know that this family member is taking advantage of them. How do you handle that?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, you're correct. I mean, and the part of the process that we go through when we investigate cases is we do talk to the alleged victim or the senior and try to figure out whether they and make an assessment as to whether they have the capacity to understand what's happening and to understand the effect that their decisions have on them, and in some cases they don't. And so unless somebody calls us, you know, we really can't look into it. And there are, of course, you know, many, many family members with powers of attorney. They're doing a wonderful job, you know, making good decisions for their parents on their parents' behalf. But
so. If these individuals are in an assisted living facility or, you know, for example, or something like that, I mean, those people are allowed to report situations that they believe are attributed.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, yes, they are mandated reporters, actually. No, it does not have to be family members.
Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the annual reporting that someone that is a conservator or a trustee or has the power of attorney, I've looked at that paperwork, and that seems fairly well. I was looking at that paperwork and what is required, the substantiation of the bank accounts, et cetera, what the money's been spent on, even though it's relatively simple form, seems that there wouldn't be a lot of fraud. Although I'm sure you're talking about the timeliness of things. But what is done when the evaluation is made of a person to be in that position of responsibility, and what paperwork do they sign as far as acknowledging their responsibility and the potential penalties that they may suffer if, in fact, they do abuse their their power? Just briefly, anyhow.
Through the chairs, Senator Thomas, I'm not real familiar with the conservatorship with that process in terms of what is required, but Kelly Hendrickson, who is here to discuss the specifics of the bill, would be able to answer those questions for you.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'll wait.
Any other preliminary questions? With that, we've got several updated fiscal notes in your packet. There's a zero fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Administration, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Law, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety, Alaska State Troopers Detachment, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Corrections, a zero fiscal note from the Alaska Court Systems, one fiscal note from the Department of Public Safety, statewide support in the amount of $48,000 in general funds to cover the cost of developing new protective order forms, updating the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, and training. And with that, I'd like to go to the public testimony portion. going to start with the folks outside of the room, and I'm just going to go down the list. I don't know. I know there's quite a list by the presenters of interested people, but I have no document as far as you guys have a logical order that they should be rolling down, so it might be a little ad hoc. But Scott Sterling, if you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Scott Sterling. I'm the supervisory attorney for the State of Alaska Office of Elder Fraud and Assistance, and I am speaking to you today from our offices in Anchorage. We are a unit of the Office of Public Advocacy. The statute for our unit is 44-21-415. And I'm prepared, Mr. Chairman, to provide a sectional analysis of the bill or however the committee would prefer that we proceed. And I will gladly take whatever direction the chair would wish.
Well, if you want to walk through the sectional, that would be fine. It's up to you how you want to present your information.
All right. Referring to the...
We're going to have a brief at ease. Back on the record, we're going to go into a brief at ease here. We've got a keyboard malfunction. We're going to get that going, and then we're going to change the order of the public testimony. We're going to drop Scott Sterling for now. We're going to pick up several other people, and then we're going to come back to Mr. Sterling later on. We're at ease. I'd like to go ahead and bring the committee back
to
order.
I would expect so.
Again, we're going to not take the testimony from Scott Sterling right now. We're going to drop him down the calendar a little bit. We're going to pick up a couple others on the off-net, and we'll come back to Mr. Sterling. Elizabeth Russo, you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Elizabeth Russo. I am the supervising attorney for the Public Guardian section of the Office of Public Advocacy, and I am available to answer any questions.
Do you want to testify? I thought that was yes. So we have no questions?
We've got lots of questions.
Okay. Senator Hoffman says he has lots of questions.
In the legislation, there's nothing that refers to how the state of Alaska will interface with tribal courts regarding the protection of the adults, and I was wondering how you might see that interface, and do you feel that it should be spelled out in the legislation as I feel it should be spelled out, so that there is no, there's a clear understanding of how the two courts interface.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it has been my experience that the tribal courts have not actively taken a role in state guardianship or conservatorship proceedings. If the tribal courts wish to participate in these or taking a more active role, I think that's something that we should certainly look at. I don't believe it was addressed in the legislation because of the lack of participation in the past.
Well, I think that the reason, there's probably several reasons, but we have this legislation before us, and there's the need to address the issues at the state level, and we should address the problems at the tribal court level and how they would potentially be interfaced in the future, and I think it would be better spelt out before that problem might arise.
We have any other questions for Ms. Rousseau? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Possibly you could answer the question I asked before about the approval process of folks that are put in charge or have the responsibility of guardians, conservators, trustees, any of those persons, quote, persons, as would be referred to in some of the changes here as far as vulnerable adults and minors and foster kids, just what is required of them as far as background checks, et cetera, just briefly anyhow.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Thomas, real briefly, this legislation does not specifically address children in the foster care system. It can overlap with minors who would be subject to conservatorship proceedings under the existing statute. As far as your overall question, not all fiduciaries are required to have any kind of reporting responsibilities. Only appointed guardians and conservators are subject to the reporting responsibilities, which is why we're particularly addressing the power of attorney issue with this legislation. The guardians and conservators, when you are appointed by the court, you are required to undergo training, an hour of education, and you sign letters of acceptance stating that you've read the statutes, that you understand your reporting requirements, and the courts then expect the annual reports. If they've got questions, they follow up with the guardians and conservators. Guardians and conservators are potentially liable for their actions if they act outside of the fiduciary their fiduciary duty.
But if I'm wrong, there is, you say, a specific, there is other statute, though, that addresses all of those other folks potentially and their responsibilities and what's required as they undertake it, not necessarily court appointed, but what it seems to be the only person maybe available, any kind of considerations given for looking at them, because I know of some cases, particularly with foster kids, where some folks have adopted or are foster parenting a dozen or more kids, which seems like almost an unreasonable number for somebody to, or for the state to allow to be foster children in those cases.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I believe that Mr. Sterling, when he testifies later, will be better able to address the first part of your question. And again, with regards to the foster children, this legislation is focusing on vulnerable adults, not necessarily the issues within the foster care system in the state.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions from Mr. Russo? Next up, Catherine Monfreda.
Yes, sir. I'm here.
Says here you'd like to testify. You want to?
For the record, my name is Catherine Monfreda. I'm chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety, and I'm here to answer any questions regarding our fiscal note.
Okay. I see no questions. The other one marked here for testimony is David Shade. Shade?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Shade. I'm the Division Director for Statewide Services, and I'm just here to available to answer any questions.
Okay. With that, we're going to come back into the room and ask Kelly Hendrickson to come forward. She's here, and then we'll bring back online Scott Sterling. I think Mr. Sterling wants to walk through the sectional analysis and then have some testimony with the two of them. So, Mr. Sterling, if you could walk us through the sectional analysis, please.
I'll just begin, Mr. Chair, and at any time would be prepared to answer questions as we proceed. Section 1 of the bill makes it a knowing violation or makes the knowing violation or attempted violation of a financial protective order a crime under Title 11 of the Criminal Code. Section 2 amends the definition of protective orders in Title 11 to include financial protective orders, which are being introduced by means of this bill, in order to protect financial security of vulnerable adults and elders. Section 3 makes the fact that a defendant in a criminal prosecution knowingly directed criminal conduct at a person 65 years of age or older an aggravated factor at sentencing. Section 4 adds that if you are a victim of fraud, that can be a basis for appointing a conservator under Title 13, Section 26 of our protection of adults and vulnerable adults statute. And the purpose of that is to allow courts to protect individuals who may not be suffering from a mental deficiency but are victims of financial abuse under circumstances that Ms. Gibbons touched on in her presentation. Section 5 adds attorneys, caregivers, and the Department of Health and Social Services as entities who may petition for conservatorship of an individual. The purpose of those additions is to widen the net of persons who can help protect victims because they are likely to become aware sooner than others of the potential for abuse or ongoing abuse.
Mr. Sterling?
Using that firsthand knowledge can petition for assistance.
Mr. Sterling, I think what we'll do is we'll try to accelerate this because you're going to walk through 50 sections and we only have till April. So we need to pick the pace up. So when you go walk through it, if you could hit on the main sections, please.
Yes, sir. The main sections accomplish two things, Mr. Chair. What they do is they add financial protection orders, which would operate very similar to the existing scheme for domestic violence protection orders. The other major portion adds ex parte relief so that an elder or a vulnerable adult, either themselves or through a friend, without a lawyer, can go to any magistrate in any court, urban or rural, and apply for protection to stop ongoing abuse. And the rationale for that is that it has become very easy through technology to steal money and identity from people now. And when people become aware of it, they need help immediately. And the idea behind this ex parte relief provision is to enable any citizen who is being victimized in that way to get immediate protection from the court to help stop it. The The other major portion, it adds temporary conservators. Most states have statutes that allow for temporary conservators. Alaska's statutes currently allow for temporary guardians, but not conservators. And in practice before the courts, many of us in the elder and vulnerable adult profession have found that the courts are reluctant to grant temporary conservators because they're not expressly allowed by statute. This would make clear that the legislature and the governor have authorized by law the appointment of temporary conservators. That, in turn, should enhance the ability of victims and their representatives and the Department of Health and Social Services to obtain immediate relief for people who are being victimized in the form of financial exploitation. Other portions of the bill, which are largely definitional, expand the definition or add the definition of such things as fraud, which exists in certain parts of our statutes. It incorporates that into this. It also includes, as Ms. Gibbons pointed out, taking the common law doctrine of unfair, undue influence and inserting that into statute so that we have a specific grounds now to assert that a trusted fiduciary, such as a power of attorney, is using undue influence. In mentioning that, I wanted to mention, in response to Senator Thomas's question, the only fiduciaries in Alaska that are required to be vetted by a court are guardians and conservators. A trustee is a private matter who is appointed by the person creating the trust. And although we have a section in Title 13 dealing with trusts, there's no requirement that a trustee who is appointed be vetted in any particular way. Alaska's power of attorney statute, also housed in Title 13, is a maximum utility, minimal regulation, and minimal liability statute. There are no specific requirements to serve as a power of attorney, and there are no specific standards, licensing, or liability provisions for to deal with actual or potential abuse. So the price we pay for having maximum utility is a greater risk of abuse of fiduciary authority by powers of attorney. That's not to downplay that utility. It's used in myriad ways by thousands of people every day. But it does carry an enhanced risk of exploitation and abuse. And in response to Senator Hoffman's earlier question, I was not, in the drafting of this bill and the working of it, I will have to go back and see what tribal courts' interactions, but I believe that is a meritorious concept and idea, and I will be happy to work on that. Those are the major portions, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions? We'll come back. We have another. Maybe we'll take the other presenter, and then we'll come back into loop questions. Ms. Hendrickson?
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Hendrickson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. Department of Law and the Human Services Section, and the offices I represent as Adult Protective Services. One half of this bill deals with Adult Protective Services. The part that Mr. Sterling ran through with you has to do with conservatorships and other financial protective orders, which is in Title 13. Adult Protective Services is in Title 47 at Chapter 24. They do have statutes there that govern their conduct, their power, and limit their power. The part having to do with Adult Protective Services is the part that I drafted in conjunction with my clients. The highlights of that section, which I think begin at Section 16, add the concept of undue influence, as Ms. Gibbons testified to the entire Adult Protective Services Code. So really what we're doing in our half of the bill is updating it to help it meet the practical needs that exist today. The idea of undue influence really permeates what APS does. And so any place in the statutes where it lists the kinds of things that somebody might make a report of harm about, abuse, neglect, self-neglect, we've added the term undue influence. Most of the sections in the APS part of the bill do that. We make no substantive changes to those sections other than to add the term undue influence. The other significant thing that this bill does in the APS section is that it updates definitions to really match what the reality is these days. It also adds new definitions, including undue influence, financial institutions, protective services, that sorts of thing. The final important thing that the APS section of the bill really does is that it expands the list of what protective services APS itself can provide short of a guardian or conservator being appointed. For example, going to a bank and staying a financial transaction, getting help with a rent application, getting other kinds of food and care that an adult might need. As the investigation continues and then a petition is filed. So instead of APS stepping in and actually doing a guardian's duties, we discovered that they needed a little bit more clear definition of what they can do as that breach, that place between the two, the bridge between the two things. So that, I think, is a significant part of the bill. Other than those three things, there isn't really anything really significant worth going over in this section.
Okay, well, thank you. We have questions. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the bill in general, Ms. Hendrickson, one of the concerns I have is that, well, first of all, I'm assuming that the victimization of the elders are a minority of cases that are out there when you're dealing with trying to make sure they're taken care of. Isn't that true? The victimization where you've got identity theft and pilfering of the accounts?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know that that is actually true. Ms. Gibbons may be able to respond to that, but I'm not sure that...
But my real question has to do, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue on with it, is there a strain that's put on those people that are cooperating with the law, that are trying to get conservatorship or guardianship from the regular people that don't get abused so that the children that might be more responsible have a more difficult time in trying to take over what their parents are doing, and you got a bureaucrat up there telling them that, you know, you got to comply with the law?
The chair, Senator Olson, I don't think that that's true, and I may be misunderstanding your question, but the process followed is no different between somebody who's doing it appropriately and somebody who's taking advantage of an elder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was my only concern.
Have other questions, Senator Thomas?
Just back to the same idea, and I I understand the and appreciate the difficulty and the difficult nature of the. Of what you're attempting to do. But earlier there was a reference made to basically a 25% increase in over basically the last year of abuses of the system. What has been done in this bill to address that? Specifically, if you have.
Senator Thomas, very specifically, the financial protective order is a quick way, since we are seeing an uptick in cases of financial abuse of elders, the financial protective order is a great way to stop that much more quickly. As Ms. Gibbons pointed out, you sometimes have to wait for 120 days before you get a court hearing. The protective order is a very quick way to address that. And I think Mr. Sterling, others at OPA, APS came up with that because we saw that uptick in cases of financial abuse. Also, certainly the temporary conservatorship is a way to get to that because you get into court within 3 days.
And if I might follow up. Yes, thank you. With that in mind, would there be, would it not be worthy of consideration of more thorough vetting of those that even if they are being suggested by the relative, that that someone intervene somewhat along the line as they're being suggested? Because I think a lot of this is family members, obviously, that are taking advantage of their parents or whatever the situation might be that are somewhat infirm. So it just seems to me that to try and affect a change and end some of this or at least reduce it, that it would be reasonable to take a closer look. And I realize that someone might object and say, no, they want their child or kid or this friend or whatever to do it, but still to make sure that at least somebody looks at it and finds out whether the person has a some kind of a background, a criminal background or something at least, or has had drug, alcohol problems or things where they've been in jail, whatever it might be.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, What I found in my experience is if APS gets a report of harm, their investigation is very thorough, and some of the things they do are informal background checks, so that when we do get into court and someone is asking to become the guardian of a vulnerable adult, if there's any issue at all that's come up in that investigation, that comes out in court. And APS, in my practice, does not take a chance on a family member when there have been allegations of wrongdoing. We try to get as much evidence as we can in front of the judge, make the decision about who's appropriate. But I think, as Ms. Russo or Mr. Sterling alluded to before, if an adult is just signing over his or her power of attorney to a family member as agent, there's nothing we can do to get involved about that, because we don't know that that's happening. That's an individual legal event that doesn't require any kind of state involvement or time before a judge. It's only when a report of harm is made to Adult Protective Services can they get involved. But again, once they're involved, it's pretty thorough.
Thank you.
Any other questions? That completes our sign-up sheet. No one else is signed up in the audience to speak, so I don't see anybody jumping up. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further review, and if the committee members could get with the department on issues that they have or clarifications that they need on this piece of legislation, and we'll continue to put that through the process. That concludes the work agenda for today. The next meeting is scheduled for Friday, January 20th, 9 a.m. We'll have five bills on the agenda: Senate Bill 51, State Vending Licenses; Senate Bill 53, Commission on the Status of Women; Senate Bill 103, Workers' Compensation for Firefighters; Senate Bill 68, Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank; Senate Bill 30, Return of Seized Property. I think those are all first hearings, same process. We'll hear them, set them aside, and continue to work on them. With that, we are adjourned.